Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
So the NFL made a decision yesterday, Seth, that they, by the letter of the law, they did not have to do. The letter of the law between the players and the owners, when they agreed to all of the COVID testing and protocol parameters, was once we get through the initial testing phase, those three tests that determine whether guys are allowed in the stadium or not, then we're going to test every day for 2 weeks. And then after those 2 weeks, if the total tests positive are above 5% or below 5%, we're going to go down to every other day. If it's above 5%, we're going to keep doing it every day until it gets below 5%. And so 5% became sort of this tipping point where that would determine whether you do every day or every other day, because this is costly to do for this many players and coaches, media members and things like that. Yeah. The NFL made the decision yesterday, even though the number of coronavirus tests are under 1% positive. So the NFL is doing really, really well. They've administered 109,000 tests overall on players and staff. The number of positives for coronavirus are 0.46% overall, 0.81% for players. So they're under 1% any way you slice it. Yeah. The NFL, despite that, said, you know what? We are going to continue to test every day all the way through September 5th.
Yeah, and you know, when we kind of ran the math on this, it didn't seem to be very cost prohibitive. And I'm always wary of saying, like, oh, the NFL's rich. They can spend money on anything. That adds up real quick, you know.
Especially with no fans in the stadium.
Rich people don't generally get rich by saying, yeah, I'll spend money on everything. Right. Like, they're careful about it. They want to spend whatever they need to spend. But it really wasn't as prohibitive as even I thought it would be to test every day. And it didn't make any sense to me why they wouldn't necessarily. It almost felt like that irrational, like, see no evil, hear no evil mode that you go into is a defense mechanism. Something, you know, when you think somebody's under your bed, but you don't want to look because you're scared of what might be under there. Like, no, you got to go look and see what's under there. It was weird that they weren't going to be more aggressive. I also thought those initial numbers were a little too, I thought that they were shooting for not necessarily. It should have been a lower standard.
Yeah, 5%. I'm with you, Seth. I think what you're trying to say is that 5% felt like a threshold where you're like, I would lower the threat. 5%'s a lot. If you're trying to get a contact sport onto the field for 16 games in a postseason in which guys spit and slobber on each other, 5% feels like it could turn into 15% like that.
I'm starting to wonder, honestly, given what the numbers have been in the NBA, baseball, and football, In the professional leagues, when players return, because even when they return, the numbers have been lower. I'm starting to wonder if those Clemson and LSU numbers were maybe botched tests or something. I mean, they were so absurdly high. Yeah. And that created a whole lot of pessimism because we thought, oh my gosh, these kids can't control themselves. Look at these kids. They must all be out partying and French kissing each other all night long and getting the COVID. And it turns out now that maybe because testing protocols or what have you have gotten better, the numbers have drastically fallen in the college environment as well. So I would encourage the NFL to continue testing as aggressively and as frequently as you can. Yeah. And I wonder if maybe early on, though, too, when it was the more invasive deep nostril test, there might have been a little bit of, hey, this is going to start wearing on people psychologically if we have to do this every single day. So maybe now that the testing is less invasive, that they'll feel better about testing more frequently.
I can tell you from having sat in the chairs in the trailers over there, the exact same chairs that Deshaun Watson and J.J. Watt and everybody sit in to get their tests, the same doctors that are doing the test, the bioreference people, it's nothing. It scares you at first because they pull out this Q-tip that looks like a javelin. It's like 10 inches long.
Yeah.
But I think it's so that their hands don't get near your face. And when I saw that thing, I'm like, you're putting that inside my nostril? What? And they're like, it'll be okay. It'll be okay. I'm like, that's what every doctor says before they jam something, before they pierce your skin or jam something in an orifice of your body. They all say it's going to be okay. And it was okay. They just swab right along the edge of your nostril. It was really easy.
I'll tell you what, that's that long Q-tip is one of the things that kept me safe for a long time. Further south on the body, because the stories I'd heard about VD tests scared me way more than anything I'd ever heard about. Like, it scared me more than getting somebody pregnant, getting AIDS, anything like that. VD test alone, I was like, there's no way in hell I'm going through that. I'm going to be as safe as possible.
Fear of testing. That's what they should have done back in sex ed in junior high. They should have said, look, if you have unprotected sex, you're going to have to go in and get a VD test, and they should just show you a picture of like a mace.
The Q-tip.
They show you a picture of like a hatchet or something.
Wait,
like that.
Wait, was I misled though? I was told that there was a Q-tip involved.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just saying, I think the more vicious a weapon they show you, the less likely you are to go out and have unprotected sex.
You know where that backfires sometimes? I can remember sometimes seeing like when they show the pictures of this is syphilis. You can't show the picture that's so disfigured that you can't even tell what you're looking at. Because then you're like, I don't even know, like,
right.
What is that? Is that a big toe or is that a genital piece?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Well, I have no idea what's going on.
Is that a mound
yet.
Of Play-Doh? I can't even tell. Like, what is that? Yeah. So, Seth, I found out yesterday I get to wear one of those Kinexon sensor vests out of practice that tell you when you're not socially distanced enough from somebody.
See, okay, I was confused about this because I saw that you're wearing this vest that takes your heart rate and it can measure your acceleration and all those things. I thought the Kinexon was the thing you wear on your wrist that tells you whether you get too close to somebody.
Well, no, there's that, too. It's a whole.
So you're wearing the vest and the wrist.
It's a whole system, yeah.
Okay.
It's a whole system, yeah.
Because you're doing the thing that they also use not just for COVID stuff, but for performance purposes.
Yeah.
Like they use this. They use this tracking and analysis to see how fast you're moving. Sean, this is what it's going to do for you. It'll boost your performance.
Yeah.
You'll probably be running more. Load management.
Mm-hmm.
So if Armin back here, our boss, is looking at the Kinexa data and thinking like, wow, Sean's not moving so fast. He's not taking notes quite as quickly as he
might
was.
Have to take Tuesday off.
He might have to have a mental health Jose Altuve day, who, by the way, quick aside, I did not like the looks of Jose Altuve when he was sitting in the stands there. He looked rough, man. Man, whoa. He didn't look like he was in a mentally healthy state.
It's been weighing on him,
Did he not? It looked like he'd been sitting on the couch for four days.
His Kinexon vest readings would not have been good. No.
And then number three, it'll help you know when you can return to play.
Oh, okay.
So they'll tell you. They'll probably tell you after the first day of practice, Sean, we don't think you're ready to go out there and practice.
Okay. It doesn't boost sexual performance or anything like that, the Kinexon?
Well, there's only one way to find out.
That's right, baby. So the media, obviously, we're using it more to measure how well we're socially distancing from one another. Seth, to the point where we go in to the trailer, the media trailer, we get our Kinexon sensor dealio, we put it on, we go to practice, we come back, we put it back in the rack to recharge, and they upload all the data to the NFL. So the NFL is going to have analytics on how well I have social distance from the likes of John McClain and Greg Bailey and Randy McAvoy and people like that.
Who are you
that.
Most concerned that you won't be able to stay away from?
Mark Berman is who we determined yesterday on In the Loop, because just based on his behavior at airports when celebrities show up, he is not good at social distancing in these situations.
Oh, just because he gets right up next
gets
to
right up in your face!
Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So
that's pretty cool. Are you going to be able to see these results?
I don't know. I'll ask when I go over there today. I'm getting COVID tested for the second time today. I think I passed the first one because they haven't called me yet. They said they would call you if it was positive, and I hadn't heard from anybody, so I believe right now I'm negative. I got to thinking, too, Seth, about all those performance things, like the heart rate and stuff like that. Like, of the media members, of the 10 of us, who would be the, like, I'm guessing, like, McClain, like, if his stuff, it would be funny, like, if McClain's raw data like that got uploaded with all the players, And they're like, wait a second, who is this person? Who's this guy has the heart rate of a 68-year-old. Who is this guy right here?
Yeah, you get swapped for some poor kid's going to get cut because Sean. Yeah, like when you're on treadmills, if you're using a heart rate monitor or something on a treadmill in a gym, sometimes they swap signals, and all of a sudden you're like, wow, I'm working really hard.
And
look at that.
And
I'm
as you know,
170.
Yeah, Seth, and as you know from having stood out of practice before, this is a measure of endurance for a lot of media members, merely standing out in the heat watching football.
Hey, look, I can tell you as a guy that was out there practicing football in the Texas heat, but then also has been standing out there trying to cover it, I think it's psychologically harder to just stand there for 2 hours in the
right?
heat.
Right, there's nothing, like, to,
with nothing
you.
To do about the but think about how much you're sweating.
Yeah.
Somebody says, Sean, COVID is supposed to be a nasopharyngeal swab. It's pretty uncomfortable. It goes in your nose and touches the back of your throat.
Not
if they're swabbing
one.
Just the nostril, ask them what type of test this is. Yeah, that's where they're doing a new one. This is maybe we should have explained that. The Texans, anybody out there listening that thinks that somehow the Texans are botching this test, they found a new – there is a new test that's less invasive, and it just goes around. You give your nose a nice little rim. I probably can't say it. You go around the rim of the nostril there.
That's it. Yeah, both nostrils. It's super, super easy. Doesn't hurt at all. Yeah, so that's what they're doing, and it's effective and all that stuff. Get sent off to the lab, and they analyze all the results.
And then the other thing the Texans are doing that a lot of teams are doing is that unless I'm mixing teams up. I believe the Texans are doing their own testing also.
Point
which
of
is
care?
Yeah, the point – I can't remember the Texans. A lot of teams are starting to do, aside from the NFL-mandated testing – the teams themselves are doing even extra testing so they can identify really quickly. Even if there's a higher false positive, they can take some guys and be like, hold on a second here, we're gonna test you again.
I'll find out. The only test we took was the one with BioReference where they send it off. Now, the good news for the Texans is, as opposed to some teams where, Seth, they've got to take all the different specimens, put them in some container, and ship them somewhere, the lab for the Texans is literally a mile and a half from NRG Stadium.
Yeah.
So it's damn near point of care. It's just putting them on a van and taking them across town.
Yeah, they should hire a bike messenger to do it.
Yes,
so like
yes.
One of those old, like Kevin Bacon in that old Quicksilver movie.
Right, with a cool uniform and everything.
Yeah.
All right, two.
By the way, can I tell you one thing that's another silver lining of this COVID stuff?
Sure.
I've never so many times in my life felt completely fine on the radio saying, you know what, I can't keep track of all this crap, and whatever. I hear other like respected people in all walks of life say that now, where like... Look, I know I should know all of this, but there's no possible way for me to know all this. Every damn team and every damn league has a different protocol right now. I don't know if the Southland Conference is playing football or not. I don't know what exactly is going on with the Big 12, and I don't care if anybody knows that I don't know.
The world is a crazy place, and it's very liberating. Absolutely. Two Houston Texans whose college backgrounds could not be more different. Both share the same feeling, though, on the direction of college football. Some really interesting thoughts on what canceling college football means for NFL prospects from two Houston Texans next. Yeah, Payne and Pendergast, Sports Radio 610 on a Thursday. Good to be with all of you. Titus Howard, Bradley Roby met with the media earlier this week. Seth, you're going to do this to me again. What the hell's so funny?
Ocho's been on fire on the text line lately. Ocho. Who's an African American male, by the way. I know we've been released from saying African American, but there's sometimes where I feel like it almost like in a legal sense I need to say African American.
Sure.
He says, I didn't know Brett Hundley was black until I saw him beat the Seahawks in relief last season. Neither Brett nor Hundley are the most ethnic of names. Ocho and Meltzer are similar in that respect. There's sometimes they're like, oh, I didn't even know that guy was white. Oh, wow.
I thought
that guy was black. Yeah, yeah. They go through their whole lives thinking a guy is a certain color.
That's
yeah.
funny. So Titus Howard and Bradley Roby met with the media earlier this week. Talked a lot about the upcoming season, but that was about the time where the Big Ten was, well, it was the same day that the Big Ten announced and the Pac-12 that they weren't going to play football this fall. Titus Howard, a small school guy from Alabama State. Bradley Roby, a guy who went to Ohio State, was probably the crown jewel of football programs of the two conferences that decided to not play football in the fall. Thought both guys had really interesting points to make, Seth, about not playing college football. Let's start with Titus Howard, who knows, if there were no senior year for Titus Howard at Alabama State, he's probably not a first-round pick of the Houston Texans. some really interesting thoughts from Titus Howard on the NCAA canceling, or on some of the conferences canceling their football season.
I mean, I don't like it at all, to be honest. And like, my biggest thing on the players not being able to play is, you know, it's not that, you know, I think like it's safer for the players to play college football right now because you don't really know like the situations. I'm not going to get into it that much. You really don't know the situations like the players have back at home, you know, so I feel like it's safer, more safe haven for the players to, you know, be there and be able to play football because these opportunities like this to come to play in the NFL and go to the NFL combine and stuff like that, that's not going to be able to happen to some of those players who like play at like HBCUs and FCS schools because their season getting canceled and then move to the spring. NFL don't wait on nobody, to be honest. Cause so if people like the Alabama, Auburn, and SEC, and they still having their seasons in the spring, I mean, in the fall, this fall, how is that going to, you know, affect the players who didn't have their season this fall and have it in the spring? Because then they're not going to be able to go to any of, like, the bowl games or nothing like that. So, I mean, I support the decision of having in the spring in the best interest of the players, but at the end of the day, it's kind of affecting those players who have aspirations to go to the NFL or to any other next level football.
You know, and obviously there's the football side of it, and as you touched on, he comes from a small school. I can sympathize with that. I came from a small school. I wasn't getting any attention from scouts until my senior season, and even some of them, it wasn't even until after my senior season. So I don't know if I probably maybe would have been invited to some training camps, but I definitely wouldn't have been drafted. There's no way in hell I would have been drafted if I hadn't gotten to play my senior season at a small football school. But the other part that was interesting there was – I think he made the point about football and how it affects football players and getting drafted, but I think he almost wanted to go into even more of like the social side of things, where it was, he said he didn't want to get too much into how some guys at home don't have the same environment. And like, yeah, a lot of guys at college are there and come from families where nobody else has ever been to college, or they've got dire economic circumstances at home, abusive environments at time, whatever it might be. And this is just, this was my read on it. I don't know if this was what he actually meant or anything, but I think it goes along with what a lot of other people have said, which is regardless of the COVID testing, I think there's an argument that they might be safer from a COVID standpoint if they go to school in that bubble, but also just a lot of these kids are better off in college. It's just flat out, they have a chance to better their lot in life. And depending on what happens with their schools or how they're going to handle their scholarships or what have you this year, perhaps this throws a little bit of a wrench into all that. And I think there's almost a humanitarian side to this where some of the guys that are kind of on a schedule and trying to lift themselves up by their bootstraps, you think for their own safety you're doing this, but you're actually kind of knocking the bootstraps out of their hands.
For a lot of these athletes, college is the safest, most functional place they've ever lived their lives.
Right.
Right? Like though it is, you know, they come from just backgrounds that are generally unsafe, independent of a pandemic going on. Absolutely. Text message, there's no way student athletes are safer at home, uncontrolled environment, than they are in school playing football, where they're monitored daily. I need to mention this, monitored daily and treated if necessary. Yeah, well, that doesn't get mentioned enough. They presumably, if they're playing football, and this goes back to, you know, actually being at school and still playing football, then they're getting tested on a regular basis.
Yeah.
You know?
So that on the COVID side of things, seeing how successful the bubbles have been or the semi-bubbles, I think that I was skeptical of that opinion several weeks ago.
You were.
And I've changed my mind on that now that I've seen the success of it. And now that I've seen, frankly, I've seen young adults act way more mature than anybody wanted to, or that most people wanted to give them credit for being. And I also think that one thing the bubbles have shown us is that, wow, if you follow some of these protocols, and they don't have to even necessarily be all that extreme, that we can actually limit the spread of this pretty effectively.
Yes.
You know, and like, so the next experiment might be, hey, if you're a university and you're actually following the protocols, what's it look like for the student population at large? But also on the, and I really do feel this, like the vast majority of kids playing college sports are not going to go on to play pro sports.
Yeah.
But many, many, many of them will get a college diploma, or a college education, whereas otherwise they might not have. And it's not like, I mean, look, they're getting an extra year of eligibility, all that, but we know how things get knocked off a track when you're young. And I would rather not risk all those kids getting knocked so far off track.
Here's Bradley Roby, whose alma mater found out this week they're not going to play football. They're not going to get a chance to compete for a national championship this fall. Ohio State, Roby on what the effect could be on players as well.
Definitely, definitely. That was the first thing I thought about. I'm like, man, what if I was coming out, you know, and I was a junior, about to get ready to be a senior, ready to prove everything, and then all of a sudden there's no season. You know, that would kind of suck. I always have to put myself in other people's shoes. So, no, when you think about that, it's like I have no idea how they're going to be able to sort out who's who and things like that. So it'll be very interesting how it moves forward. And, you know, luckily that's not my job to figure it out.
Seth, I think hearing Roby talk about that, he went to basically the Big Ten equivalent of Alabama. You know, he went to one of the three or four schools that routinely sends double-digit guys to the NFL every year. We're already seeing it. Ohio State had a decommit yesterday from a kid who's from here in Texas who is a four-star defensive end who said, you know, Ohio State, thanks for the recruitment. Thanks for making me part of the family. I've got to reopen my recruitment. The NFL, and I know this is a small percentage of the players that this matters to ultimately, but I feel like it matters to a ton of the high school kids because they all think they're going to play in the NFL.
Right. I look at a decommit because decommits do happen all the time, you know. I don't think he specifically tied it to the COVID, whether it is or not. I do think that the actual just recruiting in general, though, yeah, it's going to – for the guys that haven't committed or for the guys that now are going to take other visits that maybe were thinking about decommitting, they're actually going to go get to watch these games. Yeah, they're going to go get to visit A&M. They're going to go get to visit UT. Like, that makes a big difference.
Seth, if you're a recruiting coordinator at an SEC, an ACC, or a Big 12 school – or a position coach who recruits guys in your position, or oftentimes they're divided up by geography, that recruits your part of the country, and today you are recruiting kids and you're not using, hey, we're playing football this fall.
Yeah.
Ohio State, Penn State, USC, they're not playing. If you're not using that, you should be fired.
Right, right. Well, and I guess that's the big question is, okay, if I'm a senior in college right now, or a senior in high school right now, I guess if I'm looking at a Pac-12 school and they're not playing right now, I don't look at that as like, oh, wow, they're never going to play football again. I guess I don't look at it as, oh, wow, they didn't have the balls to play football. I think it's more just along the lines of, wow, I'm going to get to watch. If I'm thinking about going to Cal or I'm thinking about going to UT, I'm actually going to get to watch UT on football. Like, that's a pretty strong selling point.
I think you brought up a version of this yesterday that there's a chance you could be stepping onto a campus with a bunch more kids who got a year of eligibility if you go to one of those schools.
Right. If you go to Cal next year, then all of a sudden all those guys that would have graduated or gone on to the NFL, some of them, not as many at Cal,
they're
obviously
still there.
Let's talk about maybe Stanford.
Oregon or USC or any school. Like, they may not be as good of players, but there's going to be players. There's going to be more numbers at those schools. And I think, Seth, the way it gets positioned is probably the way it gets positioned already in the SEC, where their slogan is, it matters more. It's a very sellable thing to a 17-year-old kid. Like, do you want to go to that conference that canceled football? Or do you want to go where we love football down here? Like, this is indicative of the pageantry on game day down here. We kept playing football. You could see where the football falls on their priority list. I'm not saying it's all true. I'm talking about selling to a 17-year-old. This is going to be a huge recruiting tool for the schools in the South down
right,
here.
Right, yeah, and I agree with that. I guess I'm just trying to think of, like, how I would actually go about it. Like, I don't think it even needs to be that. It doesn't need to be that necessarily. It doesn't have to be an argument that's made, because that looks bad when an assistant coach says, hey, look, these cowards, they didn't play. Then all of a sudden that gets leaked. It's just simply a matter of, hey, do you want car A, which you can't even see right now, or do you want car B, which you can get in and take a test drive and look at? You're going to take car B every time, right?
Seth, I think you underestimate how over-the-top assistant coaches in college football can be in appealing to 17-year-old kids. Like, some of them will position it that way.
What I'm saying is, I don't think that's even the most effective thing. It's just the fact that you can actually see it.
Yeah.
I can actually watch Texas play football, where I'm not going to be able to watch Oregon play football.
Promising
shiny helmets.
Yeah, promising. Yeah, all 18 of them. Promising news on Justin Verlander. Yes, promising news on Justin Verlander. We have it for you next. Payne and Pendergast. A reminder, programming note, big next couple days here on the station. And if you want to make sure you're listening to all of it, download the radio.com app. You can bring that with you wherever you go. Bill O'Brien going to be on tomorrow, 8 o'clock, on Texans Training Camp Live with Mark Vandermeer, John Harris. Always fun conversations with the Texans head coach and Mark and John. J.J. Watt is going to be on tomorrow afternoon with Clint Sterner and Ron the Show Hughley. So big day on Friday here, man. Seth, practice gets started on Friday, and football feels like it is here.
So. It's the cool thing is practice is already going on. I mean, you know, like real practice starts on Friday.
Padded.
Whatever that promo we're running where what's O'Brien say? I don't know, the real football or whatever he likes to call it.
It's
real football. And it is the more these guys talk about what it's like right now, and some of the veteran players like Bradley Roby talking about what it's like, it's got to be the strangest thing that's ever happened to these guys in football, other than like maybe that first time when you're in third grade and you're trying to learn how to put on your pads, and it's all so confusing and weird. It's like that's what it feels like right now. Do you remember that? Do you remember trying to put on rib pads? Which some of the, I don't know if, I can't remember when you stopped wearing rib pads. It must be in high school. But I remember trying to figure out the rib pads and being super confused by it. Like it was an IQ test that I couldn't solve.
The one pad for me in the couple of years that I played football as a kid, there was that pad they put on your tailbone back there.
Yeah, the tailbone pad.
Yeah, I didn't like that one because it made my football pants sag a little bit in the back.
Yeah.
You know, maybe
the hip
dumpy.
The hip pads too, because nobody wears hip pads. Like you
thigh pads.
Yeah,
you know,
I didn't like the hip pads. I was like, yeah, oh yeah, thanks. Please give me something that gives me the shapely, womanly hips that I've always wanted so much.
Right.
To make me look like a Kardashian. That's what I want.
Right.
Yeah.
Were you someone who wore a long sleeve shirt underneath your jersey in cold weather, or did you go bare arms?
I went bare arms with Vaseline. You put Vaseline on to help seal the pores and keep some of the heat.
That was allowed? I feel like that would make you slipperier.
As long as you got to like rub it in, you know, like lotion almost. It's not you can't be wet and goopy like John Candy in the mud wrestling scene in Stripes.
Stripes. I'll do it. So Justin Verlander, Seth, this was mildly surprising, I guess, because the initial reports from Chandler Rome of the Chronicle, not once but twice, was that Justin Verlander is out for the year. And he still may very well be out for the year. We should point this out. But the Astros and Dusty Baker and Verlander himself appear to be ready to ride this thing out for as long as possible to see if he can get back on the mound. This is a report from Brian McTaggart of MLB.com, covers the Astros. Astros ace Justin Verlander, who suffered a right forearm strain in his first start of the season and was shut down, hopes to resume throwing a baseball next week in an effort to return this season, a source told MLB.com on Wednesday. Verlander threw six strong innings in his debut, or his opener, against the Mariners to begin the season, and then subsequently shut down for 2 weeks. But here's the key, Seth, and this is the adjective that gets me a little excited. He has been making excellent progress.
Uh-huh.
If he's making excellent progress, that's a tough thing to sit there and put right next to a report from 2 weeks ago that he's out for the season. You know what I mean? Like that, I think Chandler Rome does a nice job covering the team. If I'm Chandler Rome, and Chandler may know something where he's like, this is nothing. You know, they're riding it out. He's going to be out for the season. Just by what I'm looking at on the surface here, like if I were a betting man on these things, I would bet that, like, if I'm Chandler Rome, I'm a little nervous about my initial report that he's out for the season right now.
Well, I think like that obviously could be an errant report if he comes back. That will be an errant report. I think two things can be true, though. I think that Chandler Rome might have gotten information about the type of injury that Verlander had, and that might typically be an injury that puts people out for the entire year. Well, Verlander might be deciding to say, okay, I'm going to come back and play. And this is where, don't let the recovery time fool you, because let's say hypothetically it's like Lance McCullers, who had a partially torn UCL. It's not like Verlander can wait an extra 3 weeks and all of a sudden the UCL is going to be healed. If it's partially torn, it's partially torn until it gets fixed. So in that hypothetical scenario, Verlander would let everything calm down for a couple weeks, try to get the inflammation and pain down, and then see what he could do. So You know, look, this is why, as a writer, you always got to be careful about predicting what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah.
I suppose. Like when you said that one guy reported that George Kittle was going to announce the new contract on Friday.
Right.
Well, okay, he might get a new contract, but if it's not announced on Friday for any reason whatsoever, all of a sudden it's a wrong report.
Yeah.
Well,
and that's where with the reporting of this, Seth, that's where it gets a little dicey for Chandler, is that he reported it out for the season. Right after the game, that Saturday, the day after Verlander pitched, right after that game the next day, he reports it before Dusty even goes to the podium to talk to the media about the game that day. So Dusty arrives at the podium and he starts getting hit with Verlander questions, to where Dusty is saying, no, strained forearm, we're going to take a look at this in 2 weeks.
No, I just gave him the knuckles.
Right. Yeah. Verlander himself tweets that, that's an inaccurate report. And then Chandler reports again after that he's out for the season. I mean, almost as if to say, no, I see your report, Justin, but you're out for the year. I mean, that's right? I mean, that's kind of what he's doing. Yeah. Justin Verlander himself, the actual person who's being reported on, is saying, that is inaccurate.
Sean.
We're going to reevaluate in 2 weeks. And then Chandler puts up a report that says, no, out for the season.
If Verlander's so confident, tell me who your sources are, Verlander. I don't.
I know you're one of them.
Why don't you reveal your sources?
Right, I know you're one of your sources. I'm going to need a second source.
Yeah, I
Verlander.
Need somebody to back that up.
Right.
Get Kate on the phone.
That's right.
So, that's a really, really weird dynamic in all of this.
Yeah.
And that's where, now, regardless of all that, whether we want to get into the whole soap opera that is the reporting of this, how do you feel about 38-year-old Justin Verlander trying to come back? Like, let's say it is that hypothetical scenario, and I cannot stress enough that I'm not, like, being coy here or anything. That's just the way I'm reading it based on what I saw with Lance McCullers, who, you know, I'd heard about Lance's injury before it was ever made public, I wasn't going to go public with that, you know?
Right.
Like, it wasn't great. I was never going to say, like, hey, Lance McCullers isn't going to play, because he ended up playing.
Right.
But Lance was a young man. You think, like, okay, he's very resilient and everything. I think with Verlander, if it's some kind of partial tear of something that maybe normally most guys would be shut down, I think because of the timing of this, I'm cool with him going out and trying. And if the worst that happens is he tears it completely or he can't perform, then he's just a few weeks behind in the process. But this, if it's Tommy John surgery, hypothetically, he would be out all of next season anyway. You're just, you know, like, there's plenty of his full recovery would come sometime in the offseason there in 2022, early 2022.
It would, but it would be very easy, and I think understandable among Astro fans, Seth, if it's the same thing McCullers had in 2018, that if Verlander said, look, I'm going to shut it down, I'm 37, I still do want to pitch again, and he may not put it this way, but let's face it, I want to get paid again. Because Verlander, even if he misses 2021 after Tommy John surgery, if he goes into a batting cage somewhere and throws 95 miles an hour again, he's going to get $30 million a year from somebody. He may come back stronger from that at age 38 or 39 or whatever he is. I think it would be, even though that medically it may be fine for him to come back and pitch, I think Astro fans would completely understand, given that he's 37 and not 24 like McCullers was, if he said, guys, I'm going to shut it down. I feel like this is the better decision. Maybe even cites the COVID going on. I don't know. But my overall point, if Verlander were to shut it down with a torn UCL and say, I'm going to get Tommy John, this may be the last time I pitch for the Astros, people would understand. If he comes back and actually pitches with the McCullers injury, Seth, he cements his reputation as the most badass starting pitcher in the history of the franchise. I mean that.
Yeah.
Because he will have come back when medically maybe experts are saying it's not the best thing for him to do. He would come back to try to help this team in a shortened season where the world is against them, and maybe not with the best chance to win either. We're learning early on here. This may not be the best Astros team of the last 3 or 4 years. If he were to come back and pitch in any capacity, he would cement his reputation as the most badass starting pitcher, the most badass window of starting pitching in the history of the team. Because I think you can already make an argument that Verlander's 3-year window with this team might be the best 3-year window of any pitcher in the history of the team. And there have been some great ones. J.R. Richard in the 80s, Mike Scott in the 80s, whatever 3 years of Nolan Ryan you want to pick out. Roy Oswalt was incredible for a few years. Roger Clemens for 3 years was great with this team. None of them have been better than Justin Verlander, who is an ALCS MVP. His record is through the roof since he got here. He was a runner-up for the Cy Young. He won a Cy Young. He has been the best three-year window of pitching. If he were to top that off by coming back and pitching through a UCL injury to help this team make a run in the postseason, lock it up. It's the best 3 or 4 year window of any pitcher in the history of this team.
But, Sean, what if Osuna comes back too? Is Osuna in that conversation?
Runner-up.
Yeah. Osuna versus Nolan Ryan. Yeah, which yeah. You got?
Yeah. Nolan in so many areas.
So I don't – I'd be excited if he came back. Like, typically in these situations, whatever his deal is, whatever the injury is, I just hope, and he would be, like, he's really savvy and smart at this point in his career. It's going to, I would imagine it'd be some kind of thing where, okay, whatever the injury is, the worst thing that can happen is it gets a little bit worse and then I get it fixed, you know?
Yeah.
And he probably, he wants to pitch until he's 45, you know? If he came back and did that, and was part of a deep playoff run in this redemption year for the Astros. Yeah, there's just so much more above and beyond the actual stats and win loss record and everything else when it comes into that. Then that gets rolled right up into him coming back into the dugout with his shirt off, you know, yelling at the team to get going and all that stuff in the playoffs. It would be pretty incredible.
I'm still more worried about 2021 with Verlander than I am this year. Like, honestly, if you told me you get to pick, you know, you get to pick a scenario. Like, if I heard Justin Verlander's out for this year, but it really is a strained forearm, it's not a UCL, it's just something that in this shortened season, it would just be too dangerous to bring him back because this has been a weird season, and it would be irresponsible to bring him back because of the nature of what's happening with arms around big league baseball. But we feel with a normal offseason of rest and a normal offseason of his regimen, he's going to be Justin Verlander again in 2021. Seth, looking at this team right now, I'd probably be like, okay, like, this ain't a World Series championship team right now.
Yeah,
I would probably say, okay, give me him in 2021. Let's try to re-sign Springer, bring back, you know, Greinke's coming back, McCullers is coming back, Correa's in his last year. Let's roll and try to win this thing one more time in 2021. Yeah.
But I don't know. It's not a World Series team right now, partially because, largely because, mostly because Justin Verlander's injured.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's that. And then if Osuna comes back, obviously. Let me ask you this. Given the current state of the Texans, let's say for the sake of this hypothetical, Verlander doesn't come back. Did I say Texans?
You
Astros.
Did, yeah.
I apologize to everybody. Very little sleep last night. Who do you most want back for the next month of the season? Who could make the bigger impact? Urquidy or Yordan?
Oh, Yordan.
Okay.
Yordan. If Yordan's back and he's Yordan, he's one of the best hitters in baseball.
Yeah.
Statistically. I mean, yeah, he wasn't in the playoffs last year, but Seth, he had an OPS of like 1,100 last year.
But given the current state of the team where any one of these various relievers or starters could single-handedly lose you a game in one inning, I'm actually, for this moment right now, I almost feel, now this is what depends. Bregman's been pretty damn good over the past several weeks, or over the past couple weeks. Correa is playing very, very well. I don't know if Altuve is coming back to his old self or not, but Springer will be back too. I think the overall lineup's going to be a lot better over the course of the next month or two. I think those guys are all coming out of their shells with the exception of Altuve. We'll see.
Seth, if Verlander's not coming back, they're going to have to bury teams in 7 or 8 runs every night. And the way you do that is to put Yordan in at the 6th hole and you just turn your lineup into a mashing machine. Urquidy, I think maybe we're buying into a little too much some of those solid performances he had for 4 or 5 innings in the postseason last year. Sean, he's still a guy who's going to give you at most 4 or 5 innings right now.
Right, yeah. Sean, I'm like, I need all hands on deck with the pitching right now. Peacock, any of these guys as they come back, anybody that I can, I just have a little bit more faith compared to when I see Josh James getting ready to come into the game.
No, I'm with you, but you gave me a choice of him or Yordan. I don't disagree with your notion of the pitching, but Yordan, Yordan is a monster. You said Yordan or Urquidy.
Right, but I said for the next month, too.
Right.
So, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's still Yordan. Yordan is if he's Yordan, he's out the galaxy as a hitter.
I know. I just say, you know, Sean, maybe I just have more faith in all the other hitters than you do right now. I just see that. I feel like it's
and that could very well be.
I feel like that's going to change or is already changing right now to where Yordan is that thing that puts it over the top and turns it into the 2019 offense. But that's for the next month. I just need pitching as quick and as fast as possible. I need pitching.
Got you. Let's do some headlines.
Payne and Pendergast with today's headlines.
Hey, speaking of the Astros, they win last night. They win a series. How about that? They beat the San Francisco Giants last night, 5-1. The big hit of Martin Maldonado, 3-run homer to put some distance between the Astros and the Giants last night. Zach Greinke pitched 6 1/3, dabbled in and out of trouble throughout the night. Wasn't the most dominant performance. Ultimately, it was what they needed, 6 1/3 of 1-run ball. Probably the most entertaining sequence of the night, Seth, was newest Astro, Brooks Raley coming in a relief performance. Pitched really well in the seventh inning, kind of got out of a jam that Greinke had put the team in, got the last two outs of the seventh inning. And then for the eighth inning, out trots Josh James from the bullpen. Oh, wait, in trots Brooks Raley from the dugout, thinking that he was still pitching. Dusty Baker, it turns out, had gone over to Raley to dap him up, give him some knuckles, say, hey, nice job, but never told Raley, you're out of the game, Josh James is in. So Raley had to stay in the game because he crossed over the white line. And it turns out Dusty just left him in for the eighth inning, and the guy got a 1-2-3 inning out of it. So Dusty kind of stumbled into a nice relief performance from the newest Astro. He looked pretty good, Raley did. Bottom line is the Astros get a win. They go into an off day today feeling good about themselves.
So it was kind of the old opposite game, right? Like Dusty Baker made a really good managerial decision by doing the exact opposite of what he intended to do. That Raley just... I like to think that Raley is being a little bit coy here. Like, oh, well, me oh my, I didn't realize that I had been retired for the day. I was just strolling on back out there to have another inning of myself. I apologize, sir.
I'm sorry, Joshua.
Josh, go back to your room. I will handle these three gentlemen here.
Let the adults handle this.
Yeah.
Shall we? Meanwhile, that is Southern Bell music right there. Joe Kelly got
that actually took kind of a weird dynamic there. I wasn't comfortable with it at the end there. Let's move on. That was completely accidental.
It was. Yeah, no, Joe Kelly got his suspension reduced as well yesterday in his appeal for apparently throwing at the head of somebody is only worth 5 games, not 8 games. According to Major League Baseball, Joe Kelly get a suspension reduced for throwing at Alex Bregman.
This means a lot of people still upset that the suspension wasn't reduced to zero because they think that vigilanteism is the way to repay the 2017 Astros.
That's right.
I'm still like I'll believe until the day I die that Joe Kelly didn't even intend to throw at Correa.
Just Kelly
maybe
being
Bregman.
Kelly.
I think Bregman maybe, but like, yeah, it's just in that he, just like Dusty, in a very Dusty Baker type move, is going to get a whole lot of credit for making a mistake.
Right.
Yeah. I think he was just throwing wild throws, but it was the facial expressions that drove it all home. So now he's being hailed as a hero because he made poopy faces at somebody.
Next headline. The Rockets lose yesterday to the Indiana Pacers 108-104. I don't think it really matters to them because I think deep down the Rockets want to be on the 4-5 line in the Western Conference. Winning games the last couple nights might have bumped them up to the 3 seed at some point. Instead, they lose yesterday. They got one more game left against the Sixers, but it won't matter. They will begin the playoffs, Seth, facing off against the team that they pulled off the biggest trade of the offseason with, the Russell Westbrook Chris Paul trade. They're going to face the Oklahoma City Thunder in the first round of the playoffs in what to me is the most intriguing first round matchup of any of what the 8 matchups are going to be in the first round of the NBA playoffs. The big worry for the Rockets right now is what's wrong with Russell Westbrook? He missed yesterday's game from routine rest. It was a back-to-back. They would rest even a healthy Westbrook on a back-to-back, but he did get an MRI on his quad, which was a contusion he suffered earlier this week. The MRI did show some stress on that quad right now. He won't play Friday. They're going to evaluate it throughout the week. And D'Antoni seems mildly concerned about Russell Westbrook getting going next week. What's your concern level on Russell Westbrook right now?
On a scale of 1 to 10, I'm a 5.
Okay, me too.
And it's not that I don't think he's going to be gone for the whole playoffs or anything. It's just that I need him at peak Russell Westbrook. And without peak Russell Westbrook, you know what it is, Sean? I've allowed myself to look at these guys as genuine title contenders now. I didn't know what small ball was really going to look like. And even though they haven't been as consistent as I would have liked, or at least they weren't while they were still trying to win games, I've seen enough now to see what they're capable of doing, and that they're capable of making up for the size with steals, with pace, with all those things. So now I'm not just kind of cruising into the playoffs hoping they make a good show of it. These guys, if they're healthy, can actually win this whole thing.
Okay, are they set up, Seth? This is going to be a bit of a negative point of view right now. I'm very optimistic about the Rockets. I share the point of view you just had right there that I think a lot of national media share is one that I share, which is they are at the very least a dangerous team. They are a dangerous team, if nothing else, if not a title contender. Does the fact that the stock, even though they lost the last two nights, I don't think people are paying much attention to that. The stock seems to be pointed up on the Rockets right now among national media and people that follow the team here. But they're playing Oklahoma City, who is a dangerous team themselves in a different kind of way. Are the Rockets set up here, Seth, for maybe the worst case scenario where, boy, the expectations are back to where we thought they might be before the season. Oh, wait, they're playing Oklahoma City. And Oklahoma City has played the Rockets well this year. They have played the Rockets well this year. Seth, what is the offseason going to be like if the Rockets not only get knocked out in the first round, but get knocked out by the team that they shipped off every first-round pick they have from now until 2026 to get rid of Chris Paul?
Hey, some of those are swaps, which I guess is you're still losing that pick.
Yardish? Yeah, maybe.
As long as the Rockets are better than No. As long as they're – hey, Sean, as long as the Rockets are worse than Oklahoma City, those swaps don't look so bad
really good
now,
point
do they?
There, Seth.
Yeah.
Boy, that's like Inception. I don't know what to root for.
Well, it'll be bad because especially what will immediately be trumped up is that, hey, James Harden couldn't get along with Chris Paul. I think that more of the blowback will be on Harden than on Daryl Morey himself, because that was the issue. Chris Paul and James Harden just
yes.
didn't see eye to eye on what kind of basketball they wanted to play. And then also that Chris Paul is older than Russell Westbrook. Chris Paul was banged up, all of that. But look at what we have, and especially if it's because Russell Westbrook is banged up, but Chris Paul stays healthy the whole series.
Yeah.
That would be another big part.
Yeah, boy, that's a great point, the irony of that, right? If Russell Westbrook can't play because it's quad, but Chris Paul plays all five, six, seven games, however long the series goes, Chris Paul's been healthy this year. He's been really, really good for the Thunder. He's been an all-star for them. There's just no other way to slice it. It's been a real revelation for the Thunder this year.
Well, that's right, and I think that's what a little bit of, I guess maybe the narrative or whatever you want to call it last year, I think a lot of people just assumed that it was more Chris Paul not being good anymore.
Yeah.
Where there was more to it, you know, and we knew that here.
All right, next headline. The Texans made a signing this morning. They signed former Raider defensive lineman and former Sam Houston State Bearcat defensive lineman, former second-round pick, P.J. Hall, who was let go by the Raiders last week, actually was traded by the Raiders last week to the Minnesota Vikings for a seventh-round pick. That trade got nixed because P.J. Hall failed his physical, and so he was cut loose by the Raiders. He comes back home to the state of Texas, and we'll see, Seth, if the Texans can. Well, it'll be interesting to see how in the mix he is early on because, as we mentioned, he failed a physical with the Vikings. That's why that trade was voided. There is a lot more flexibility now for teams with the practice squad. And I know O'Brien was asked about that last week. Hey, does this expanded practice squad give you some places where you can get a little creative with the roster? And he looked giddy about it. He said, yeah, absolutely. And one of those areas of flexibility is that not only is a practice squad bigger with 16 guys on it as opposed to 10 or 12, but there are six spots for veterans. These are guys you wouldn't normally be able to even put on the practice squad. P.J. Hall, my guess, he hasn't been around as long as of what a veteran would be considered for the practice squad, but he's played enough football to where I think he'd normally be ineligible for it. Well, they can stash him there now while he recovers from whatever this injury is.
The only thing about that is it's not so easy to stash people on the practice squad. Other teams can sign people off your practice squad.
You get to freeze four every week with these new rules.
Can you freeze the veterans, though?
Well, you can freeze right. four every week.
Okay, if you freeze him, then it's no big deal.
Yeah,
because he was good enough to be – the Vikings did want to trade a seventh-round pick for him.
Right.
So, look, P.J. Hall's got a lot of upside, and he's a fast dude for somebody that size. He's only 6'1", which I don't care about at all because I think under – I think short defensive tackles are among the most undervalued assets out there. Yeah. Some of the best, like John Randall, Jerry Ball, two very different types of athletes, but two of the best defensive tackles who ever played the game. Both those guys were 6'1".
Yeah.
But sometimes coaches just, they love 6'3", 6'4", 6'5". Anthony Weaver played next to a guy in Kelly Gregg who is an awesome 6-foot-tall nose tackle. And I think he probably sees maybe something that a lot of other people are overlooking in the, I think P.J. Hall's on the short side of 6'1", too. He might be closer to 6 foot than 6'1".
I can't think of a single guy that Weaver's coached as the defensive line coach here that hasn't increased their stock, that hasn't played above what their pedigree was. You know, street guys.
D.J. Reader is a fifth-round pick.
Fifth-round pick. He's the highest-paid nose tackle in football. Brandon Dunn was a street guy. He's on a second contract now. Angelo Blackson, a guy who was released by the Titans and was a street guy, he got a second contract. Charles Omenihu had a nice rookie year. So it's a decent list of guys who've come in and played a ball. Look, if you do that with P.J. Hall, you're getting a guy who's a former second-round pick. I mean, that's a talented guy. All right, next headline. A Houston legend passes away yesterday. If the words Veer offense were trending on Twitter yesterday, it's probably because of the passing of the legendary University of Houston head football coach Bill Yeoman, who died yesterday at the age of 92. He was reportedly battling COVID-19 last month. In fact, I had seen reports where he was recovering from COVID-19, which made me think, this is the most badass 92-year-old on the face of the earth that he's battled through COVID-19. Unfortunately, he passed away yesterday. Yeoman, of course, the head coach at U of H in 1962, became the head coach of U of H in 1962 after serving as an assistant coach at Michigan State for 8 seasons. And he coached it with the Cougs until 1986 and was the winningest coach in school history, won 160 games, and a true legend. So RIP to Bill Yeoman and thoughts and prayers to his family.
I'd say two things about Bill Yeoman. One, among the first coaches to start recruiting black players into the Southwest Conference, and got a lot of flack for that, played black quarterbacks. But also, as you mentioned, invented the Veer offense, which has been 55 years now, where it's still the basis for a lot of what became the triple option, or zone reads, all of that. Like, it just, he invented the Veer option, which is a pain in the ass of an offense to run against. And I will say too this, Sean, I was struggling with, I tweeted something about this yesterday, and I talked about how hard it is as a young defensive end to play against the Veer. And all these guys kept tweeting at me saying, like, no, you just hit the quarterback every time. All you do, defensive end, hit the quarterterback every time. I got to tell you guys, I want to say this gently. If you're a high school kid and your coach is telling you as a defensive end to hit the quarterback every time when you're facing the Veer, this is what you need to hear. It's because your coach doesn't think you're smart enough to do anything else. So work harder at being able to do more things against the Veer. You're screwing the linebackers behind you by if your coach is telling you to hit the quarterback every single time. You got to attack it different ways than just that.
You didn't want to say this, but basically you're a dullard, if that's what they're telling
you. No. It's just maybe you're not there yet. You know, I'm just letting you know there's one more step you can take.
I got you.
To where sometimes you want to string it out a little bit. Give time for the supporting players to come up and tackle the pitch, man.
All right. You are listening to KILT and KILT HD2, a radio.com station.
But I will say, though, Bill Yeoman, who I was lucky enough to meet a couple times, just like the consummate gentleman. Mm-hmm. Just like you couldn't ask. He's the kind of guy you hope you are when you're 90 years old. You know, like you hope you can conduct and comport yourself that way. And it really was, I don't think you can really overstate what a huge influence he had on the game of football by creating the Veer offense. It's always dicey when you start talking about who invented what in football, because usually there are influences and stuff. I think the Veer might be the one situation where almost everybody says, yeah, it was pretty much Yeoman who did most of this with some other influences, but very, very impressive.
Text message last night, KHOU Sports said it was natural causes, according to his son, that caused the passing of Bill Yeoman. Yeah, no, I'm just mentioning he was recovering from the coronavirus, I think, last week. So appreciate the heads up on that, texter. Hey, tomorrow, Bill O'Brien and J.J. Watt both going to be on the station here on Sports Radio 610. First day of Texans practice. Padded practices, so it's a big day. We're talking to the big names. Coach O'Brien on at 8 a.m. So this time tomorrow, make a note, 4 minutes ago this time tomorrow, He will be on, the coach of the Texans will be on with Mark Vandermeer and John Harris during Texans training camp live. J.J. Watt going to be on in the afternoon with Clint Sterner and Ron the Show Hughley. So training camp going on right now. No one is bringing it to you quite like we are at Sports Radio 610. I'll be calling in with my updates to In the Loop and to Clint Sterner and the show in the afternoons as well with updates from practice. I'll be updating on Twitter as well. And so follow Sports Radio 610 at Sports Radio 610 on Twitter. And download the radio.com app to bring us with you wherever you go. Seth, one other thing didn't get to in headlines, but a morsel worth cleaning up here, as long as we're talking about potential defensive line reinforcements out there. Everson Griffin did find a home yesterday. And I think it surprised a few people. The Dallas Cowboys signed Everson Griffin to what was a pretty reasonable deal.
Yeah, well, this is what I feared with Everson Griffin. Yeah. And by that, I mean, like, I feared that this would maybe be available to the Texans, but they wouldn't. I understand them now. They just drafted a young defensive tackle and a young edge player. Everson Griffin's a little bit different type of a player than both the Texans' young players, but I get why they didn't. But yeah, he signed what, a 2-year, $10 million deal?
What I saw was 1-year, $6 million.
Oh, 1-year, $6 million. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, Everson Griffin is. It sounded, as much as people never want to believe this, it sounded like Everson Griffin genuinely wanted to go find a good fit. You know, he didn't want to sign anywhere until he could actually visit places and talk to people and see him face to face. And I don't know how much of the visits are even still allowed right now.
I'm glad you mentioned that. That was a big piece of news yesterday, is that teams are allowed to have guys visit again. So they can do tryouts and things like that. There were a lot of players very happy with that.
But I think he was being very careful with it. So I would have loved Everson Griffin was. I don't want to say he would have been a guilty pleasure. I thought it would have been a really nice piece to bring, especially with a veteran player like himself, that if you could get him at the right price, he's going to bring an extra element of pass rush at a very good price. I don't know if he'd even have to be an every down player, but it would have been, a luxury to have him on there, given that you just used two draft picks on defensive frontline players. I get why they didn't. They're kind of, even though you don't have like a lot of marquee guys up there other than J.J. Watt right now, you've got every slot filled.
Yeah, if I'm Griffin, I'm looking for a place to go where there's somebody else who's going to get the double teams and get the load on that defensive line. The Texans would have fit that bill with J.J. I think the Cowboys with DeMarcus Lawrence on that defensive line and some other guys who can get after the passer a little bit, probably, you know, not, you know, the heavy lifting for Griffin as a member of the Cowboys defense, probably not what it might have been in some other places. 1 year, $6 million, $3 million in base salary, $3 million in roster bonuses. So that's the deal that he's getting there. Yeah. 74.5 sacks in his career. So yeah, he's been a nice Hall of above average player. You know, not Hall of Fame, but Hall of above average. Everson Griffin has been a nice productive player in his career. Now he'll be a Cowboy. So there you go.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.